Hopefully, Beyonce will be there. And the lectures will be at unusual times. So there's today, it's on Thursday, and it's on Friday, because we're God listening, we'll be working on Friday due to scheduling problems. So so the one on Friday won't be recorded, but it'll be happy. So, so today, Thursday, Friday, same time, same room.
Okay, I think I turned this on. I think I got everything right here.
Okay, thank you for the invitation to come here and speak about standard model and particle physics and collider physics and LHC and so on. And today's lecture is going to mostly cover the standard model Higgs and some supersymmetry ideas connected to standard model like Higgs boson. And the subsequent lectures are going to be on some more detailed descriptions of supersymmetric theories and what that has to do with the LHC, how to find it at the LHC, and extra-dimensional theories. And the focus is as I say, mainly on Higgs boson physics, with some connection, especially in the extra-dimensional case, on gravitational physics. And there is actually a connection between sort of gravity-like physics and Higgs boson physics in the extra-dimensional scenario, which I hope to be able to cover. Now, first, I've made one panel on the board of the standard model Higgs, and I want to write that down and go through it quickly for those who haven't seen it for a long time. One of the biggest problems that we face today in particle physics is understanding why particles, elementary particles, get mass. Why does the W boson get mass? Why does the Z boson get mass? Why do the top quark and B quarks and the leptons get mass? And this is a major problem because everything we say about it is speculative, including the standard model Higgs boson. It's a speculative object. And being speculative means we need to be very precise about how we talk about it so that we can judge if ideas are worth pursuing experimentally. And in this case, certainly it's worth pursuing experimentally. And then what are the problems associated with the explanation that we are putting forward? And then the solution to these several iatrogenic problems of solutions then create phenomenology on their own as well in the collider environment and astrophysics environment and so on. So we begin with the simplest explanation of all of why particles, elementary particles, have mass, and that is the Higgs boson explanation. So we posit in the standard model that there is a Higgs boson. And that Higgs boson is a doublet under SU2. And I can write it in this suggestive form, a G plus minus, and then a V plus H plus IG naught, where the Gs are Goldstone bosons associated with the symmetry breaking of the SU2 cross U1 field. And they turn into the longitudinal components of the Z and the W. And there is a vacuum expectation value associated with this doublet, value 246 GeV. And how do we know that the vacuum expectation value is 246 GeV? Well, we plug into the covariant derivative this Higgs field, take the covariant derivative acting on it, and then expand it and with the vacuum expectation value. And if you go through that exercise, this is the SU2 bosons, and this is the U1 hypercharge boson, then you get MW squared and MZ squared times a factor that depends on the Higgs boson, 1 plus H over V. This H is the sole propagating degree of freedom out of the Higgs doublet. This is the vacuum expectation value, where the W is equal to the gauge coupling times the VEV. We know what the W mass is. We know what the gauge coupling strengths are. That just tells you how the W's and Z's interact with fermions. And so just dividing MW squared by G squared and factor of 1/2, you get out the VEV. And so it's the VEV is 246 GeV. And likewise, for the Z, you have this MZ squared equals these factors, and you get out an elementary particle mass for the Z. And the fermions is a very similar story. Yukawa coupling times the left-handed component to the fermion, coupling to the right-handed component through a Higgs boson stuck in the middle, plus the complex conjugate. And you get out MB, where MB, this is the mass of the B quark as an example, is the Yukawa coupling times the VEV over square root of 2. And all you have to do is just set the Yukawa coupling to the appropriate value, and you get out the B quark mass of 4.2 GeV, plus or minus some uncertainty. All right, this is the simple, basic Higgs boson explanation for elementary particle mass. There are a few difficulties in this explanation. But first, let's highlight the best thing about this explanation. The best thing about this explanation is that this one field does everything. Does everything you need it to do. It gives you mass for the vector bosons and simultaneously can give you mass for the fermions. That's a good thing if you're into simplicity and economy. This speaks a lot to the Higgs boson explanation. But what could possibly be wrong with it, with this explanation? Well, one, we don't know how the Higgs gets its vacuum expectation value. And let me just state what the standard model solution to that is. Right now, we just assume that there was a vacuum expectation value. How does it get a vacuum expectation value? It's actually an infinite number of solutions or theories with just this one field that could do that, depending on various powers of Higgs fields that you could put into a potential. But the simplest idea is just to write out a scalar potential like this. Assume that this mu squared is negative. So this is out of freshman condensed matter physics and phase transitions. This is mu squared is negative, lambda, let's say, is positive, and you get out a potential that looks like this. At the origin, it's zero. And then this turns it down because of the negative. The lowest dimensional operator always wins at this smallest field configuration value. So it turns it negative. But ultimately, the phi to the fourth will win out. And as it wins out, it goes up. And then the minimum, this is the minimum here. This is equal to V over square root of 2. This lower component of this doublet. So V over 2 is the minimum. And all one needs to do is set the parameters correctly so that you get the right value of V. So it's some infinite space of mu squareds and lambdas will give you 246 GeV when put in this formula properly. And the physical propagating Higgs mass state, if you do an expansion about this minimum and look at the spectrum, you will find three massless states. Those are the Goldstone bosons associated with the standard SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge going to U1 E and M. So there's three Goldstones. plus minus g zero, and then this is the physical Higgs here for a total of 4 degrees of freedom, which the SU2 complex doublet has. Yes.
You start with the square of the gradient.
This is just the scalar potential. There's also the kinetic term. Yeah. So the kinetic term is part of that covariant derivative. That's that first partial derivative there. Okay. So this is the.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
How do you know what value of g to take?
Little g. You know what value to take there because of various experiments. For example, muon decay. Muon, and then E, there's a G's here. You know the mass of this W from looking at peaks.
This is the thing where little G cancels out, right? That's the source of information about G fermion. Oh, exactly, expectation.
G fermion is equal to 1 over square root of 2 V squared, right? And so if you know the W mass, and you know that this is one way to get out G, if you measure the W mass through some peak at a collider.
Oh, I'm saying in practice it's going the wrong way. Like you first measure the muon mass, because it's a muon decay, it's a most precise measurement, and you extract the background classification value that way.
Yeah, actually, if you look at my lectures from a couple of years ago here, there's a whole story on just that. Yeah, but that's one thing. There's an infinite number of ways to do it. There's Q Q bar to W to L nu, and these are G's there. So the right way you get all of these parameters is by global fit theory here. And then you can get these parameters for several decimal places.
So what's the error on you on V?
The error on V is approximately 1%. And this has to do with the how well the precision electroweak measurements are done at the colliders and the theoretical calculation that's involved. So all the parameters that make up the standard model are sort of at the 1% level. G Fermi is, for example, is actually observable. And so it is known to be much better than 1%. And alpha is actually a really well-measured observable, which is known to be much, much better than 1%. And same with MZ. So those three observables are known extraordinarily well. But when you want to extract out the fundamental parameters in the end, then you feed into it a bunch of other observables, and then back them out, and you get usually about 1% or less error on the fundamental parameters. Yes?
Two questions. So why do you choose U squared to be negative? And also, why not add 9 to 5 to the 6?
Okay, so in fact, I could. In the infinite number of theories that I could propose, one of them would be, let's call this mu prime squared, which is positive, lambda prime to the fourth, which is negative, plus, let's call it eta over lambda squared by 5 to the 6. Lambda is just some new scale. And this, eta, positive. That theory would then give me a potential which looks like this. And then I would have a minimum here. Now, that's not the standard model theory, but it's perfectly valid theory to analyze. In fact, I had analyzed this theory a few years ago. And you can watch how the high temperature progression of the theory from the early universe to today proceeds, and this can actually see the first order phase transition in the early universe, a theory like this. So as I say, there's an infinite number of theories and solutions that can give you the same BEV. The phenomenology of this is different. The Higgs phenomenology is slightly different. But it's only different in the higher multiplicity Higgs production phenomenology. The phenomenology associated with a single Higgs is the same. And it's unlikely that any collider for 20 years will be able to do the multiple Higgs phenomenology. It's possible on the edge, but so most things map to the same phenomenology quite nicely.
The theory is not renormalizable.
The theory is not renormalizable, but that doesn't bother me at all.
Good.
That's good. Okay, you're happy with that. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we solve
that problem, but in the solution to that problem, we come up with two other problems. One is it hasn't been seen yet. We haven't verified this explanation at all. So how do we go about verifying this explanation? So this okay, so imagine it's 19, what year should we go to? 1984, prehistory. 1984. What mass would you let's say you saw the standard model, you know about the W. The W was measured by 1984. You're pretty confident that Z was right around the corner. But you wanted to know what the Higgs boson mass is going to be, because you have this explanation, you think it's really elegant and nice. What is the Higgs boson mass? What number would you come up with? Well, you would look at, where is my Higgs mass? Right here. You would look at this equation, and you say, well, I know what V is. V is about 246 GeV, and I know what 2 is. 2 is about 2. And lambda, order 1. Okay, so the Higgs boson mass should be sort of 200, 300 GeV within order 1 factor, something like that. That's sort of what you would have thought. So it's important to keep in mind this order estimate of what you expect the Higgs boson mass to be, to give you a feeling for how experiment has progressed since 1984. So what has experiment done to look for the Higgs boson? Well, there's a long line of experiments, but the most recent really good crack at finding the Higgs boson was LEP2. And this is, I'll write verification again here. LEP2. Now what they did was they said E plus E minus collisions can go to Z and a Higgs. So this is their best shot at finding the Higgs boson. And the Z can decay into anything. This is a clean E plus E minus environment. The Higgs is going to want to decay over much of the parameter space available to this machine to BB bar. So this signal is a BB bar plus Z, where the Z could decay into L plus, L minus, jet, jet, even neutrino is fine. Sort of there's a so-called recoil mass. Is MZ, and this has an invariant mass MBB of MH. So you look at all the events that have a BB bar plus things that look like a Z, and you don't find a signal. You don't find a signal beyond any backgrounds. Well, how far can they go for finding the Higgs boson at LEP? Well, to produce it, you need the center of mass energy to be greater than mz plus mh. So kinematically, that is a requirement. So mh has to be, it can be probed up to square root of s minus mz. And it turns out that LEP2 ran up at around 260 eV. It started falling off around there. So this tells you you can go up to about 115 GeV maximum to find the Higgs boson at LEP. So that's a far cry from the 300-ish GeV that one would have sort of estimated by order one factors. Nevertheless, it's a good crack. It's you're trying to find it directly, and this is, you know, it takes a long time to build colliders, and this is what they did. And they found, if you want to be very technical about it, they found that there is a limit. The Higgs boson has to be greater than, the Higgs boson, the standard model, has to be greater than 114.4 GeV at 95% confidence level. Okay? So that is...
So this is an off-shell Z. So the center of mass energy coming through this collision is greater than MZ, so it's off-shell. And this is a production of 2 1-shell states. Okay? There's actually another direct search that was done for the Higgs boson that was fairly effective at Tevatron. Tevatron, it's filled with controversy about their search, but they claim that between 160 GeV and 170 GeV, the Higgs ruled out. So this is a recent CDF. This 95%. Sorry. I don't have a specific complaint, but I can tell you what other people's specific complaint is. It's not so much a complaint as it is an interesting fluctuation. Some people question
that the theoretical error was taken into account properly for making this limit. But I think even more importantly is that there was a tremendous fluctuation downward of the background, which meant that they were able to get a higher sensitivity for exclusion than the expectation, given the amount of data that they had. And I think if it's very possible that this exclusion limit would go away after analyzing more data. This is just the nature of how statistics operate like this. But the only reason why it's controversial is that I saw a talk where people were angry. So that's, I have no reason to doubt it. Yes?
That's around twice the W mass.
Yes.
That's a dominant decay of Higgs into W plus W.
Yeah, that's right. And
that's really important.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the reason why the Tevatron is sensitive in this area, is because when it decays into Ws nearly 100% of the time, they start doing a much better job. If you lose branching fraction into Bs, B quarks, problem. And Tevatron has many, many B quarks running around, and it's hard to separate that out from background. So it's not surprising that it should be around 160 when you start becoming quite sensitive. All right, so that so let's say that now we know that the standard model digs. Maybe I should write it here on a line. So this is the standard model digs. Standard model, and I'm going to write 114 GeV here, 160 GeV, 170 GeV, and then this goes up to sort of about TeV. So this lambda being order one, maybe get sort of an order almost up to a TeV.
Higgs mass. Yes.
How did I get to 114? The 114 was this, the fact that they did not find the Higgs.
No, you had a lot of options, but that was different from your calculation.
Were you thinking my calculation was 115?
Yeah, but that's, and Higgs mass is less than 115,
right? So the Higgs mass, it can only probe, so I can probe a Higgs mass that is less than this value. And the fact that they didn't see it means that the Higgs has to be higher than that value. The fact that they didn't see it. Yeah. And so, so this is ruled out. This is ruled out. And we have the remaining stretch here. So let's talk about the remaining stretch briefly for the Higgs boson. And that is through precision electroweak analysis. So in the precision electroweak, the goal is to collect as many observables as possible that depend on the Higgs boson, even indirectly and virtually. So a full complete precision electroweak analysis will include the Fermi constant. This is an observable. It's associated with muon decay. The alpha observable, you know, Z's. These are measured very, very well. Forward backward asymmetry associated with leptons. This is when you watch a Z decay at left, there's certain angular correlations of the leptons, and that angular correlation will be related to the Swarm Background asymmetry and be sensitive to all the loop corrections. There's Swarm Background asymmetry B core, there's A left right asymmetry for electrons at SLC. There's a W mass. This is at slack. W mass at Tevatron. And also at left two. Measure the W mass directly. The left right asymmetry is I have E plus E minus coming in and hitting each other.
If I polarize the electron left polarized, and then see what the total cross section is, versus polarizing it right and seeing what the total cross section is, and I measure it really well, it adds to my collection of precision electroweak observables. Now, what can happen in a Z decay is I can have a Higgs boson pop out of the vacuum, and then annihilate away virtually, and then decay into the L plus L minus, and so on. I can have various internal loops that depend on the Higgs boson at the higher one loop level. So this kind of diagram is down by a factor of alpha over pi compared to this tree level diagram. So this is of order, or, you know, 1%-ish or so. And so measurements better be quite good if you want to be sensitive to this higher order in perturbation theory. And the measurements have been done very well over the last few decades. And so what they're able to do is construct a chi-squared analysis where I look at the theoretical calculation, which depends of any given observable, which depends on the Higgs mass plus other parameters in the theory, minus what was measured experimentally, squared over the experimental uncertainty. And I do a very fancy minimization process and find out what the best possible values of the Higgs mass are as a function of chi-squared. And I'm going to write it as delta chi-squared in H. And you find something like this, where this is, depending on the fit, this can be as low as 80 GeV, or even lower in some cases. The best fit value for the precision electroweak observables is 80 GeV. But then you apply the statistical test of what the range of Higgs masses can be and still be in concert with the data. And so that is delta chi-squared has to be less than 1.96 squared, I think it's the number, for 95% confidence level. And that gives you an upper bound of what the Higgs boson mass is. And that upper bound is 176 GeV, according to one of the recent electroweak reports. Yes?
Does this include that lower limit that you mentioned upstairs?
This does not, but you can apply the lower limit and then put a wall here in the fit.
But if you want to do it technically correct, you have to just add the data to that chi square, right? All the data.
That's
you
right.
The one upstairs to that lower limit.
That's right. And that lower limit actually is a brick wall in the fit.
So it just gives a brick wall. Yeah.
It gives a brick wall, but the brick wall affects it. There's a fancy statistical analysis right. Where that brick wall will affect the upper bound of it. This number it does not include that brick wall.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. So this is 176 GeV. By the way, in the measurement of the top mass is of course very important in this as well. So we can add that to the list of observables. What goes wrong if the Higgs mass is greater than 176 GeV? What goes wrong? What goes wrong is that there's a little bit too much Higgs effect in these observables. And all the observables just move a little bit away from each other. Think of observables in this big multidimensional space, and there's correlations among the observables depending on what other observables are. Like the Higgs mass. As I move the Higgs mass observable, then the other observables sort of twist and strain away from their best fit values too far. They strain away from the experimental values. If you can make one experimental value of, say, MW work out perfectly, then something else, like the Horvath asymmetry, goes way off. And so you can't go much further than this without running into serious troubles.
How much does the brick wall change, the 176? Is it like
it's like 10 GeV or something. It's not much. Yeah. And it's wrapped up in a lot of technical discussions about statistics on how to deal with a brick wall in a chi-squared fit with continuous variables. And I'm not sure that there is a really rigorous conclusion that one can make about how to deal with that properly.
I don't understand. Why don't you do what he suggested and just add the lab 2 data and then do a chi-square for everything?
You do. You add all the lab 2 data. That's right.
And that's not a brick wall. Right? That'll be something that'll be a smooth brick wall. It'll be a smooth brick wall, and then there's no ambiguity about how to deal with that.
Which observables are you referring to?
But I'm just saying that when you put a brick wall there, you're saying that the lab 2 told me that the Higgs had to be larger than 114 or 150. But if I put in the lab 2 data there and I did my chi square with everything, I mean why would that be a
why is it like a brick wall? Why isn't it
just, I'm just saying that would be no.
Yeah, okay. The reason being is that, so first, I'll make two comments. One, all the left two observables are used, but the one that's under question at the moment is the Higgs mass one. So the reason why I called it a brick wall is that if you go a little bit below 114 GeV, just a little bit, you're ruled out by 99.9999999% confidence level. I mean, it's extraordinarily high confidence level, just going 1 GeV lower. If you go 1 GeV higher, 116 GeV, nothing said, zero is said by LEPT2. And so although perhaps I shouldn't call it a brick wall, it's a brick wall with a 2 GeV sort of width. Okay. Yes?
Question. In the particle data group, what the global fit 77 plus 28 minus 22,
yep.
Which is much more stringent.
Oh, no, it's very, very, well, yes. You will find almost every other month a different fit.
I found that.
So 77 is very close to this 80. And then if you, so the 176 is from the big electroweak working group report. You'll find other reports where it's a little bit more stringent, you'll find other reports where it's a little bit less. And so sometimes what I was going to do up here was going to write it this way. 200 GeV. It's pretty clear that things are ruled out above about 200 GeV. And then maybe, you know, down to, it could be ruled out down to 170. These chi-squared fits are just a little bit fluid, depending on how many observables you put in and how to treat them and so on. So I'm going to just say 200 GeV, and things are ruled out above 95% confidence level. This is what remains of the standard model phase for the Higgs boson.
One last question about phase.
Yeah.
What's the value of the chi-squared at the minimum? Is it a good fit there?
It's a good fit, and it's a good point. When you do a statistical analysis, you have to ask and answer two questions. And before you, this is the second question. The first question is what he just asked, which is it a good fit? And a good fit, there's you know, precision statement about that. The goodness of fit is about 1 per degree of freedom. So it's plenty good enough. And that's all you have to do is ask yourself a binary question. Is this an adequate good fit? Clearly, it's a good enough fit. And so you say it's a good enough fit. Then your second question is, once it's a good enough fit, go to the chi-squared minimum, and then look at the delta chi-squared for the parameter that you want to get an interval on, an allowed interval on. And this is the delta chi-squared procedure. So in the electroweak working group reports, they will tell you the chi-squared per degree of freedom, and that's usually in the caption of the table, and then the plots are the delta chi-squareds. Okay, so another problem that you
run into, so this is the second problem, so problem number two. Okay, so I'm gonna state it somewhat controversially, since why not, right? Nobody believes it. So I think it's just a big theme in particle theory. Anybody that works on particle physics long enough, the electroweak sector just doesn't believe this. And there's multiple reasons. Multiple reasons for it. But I then want to make it a little bit more nuanced, what I mean by nobody believes in it. I believe, so I'll tell you what my viewpoint is, I think that there is a Higgs boson, a state that acts very much like a Higgs boson and very similar to this. But I don't believe that this is all there is to the electroweak scale. Okay? And I'm going to, over the next few days, and including the rest of the day, I'm going to try to present that argument sometimes directly and sometimes indirectly. The big difficulty is there's this mu squared operator in front of the phi squared, and this is supposedly electro weak scale. Okay, so we went to this big song and dance about how the weak scale. How do you give masses to the W and Z, and how do you give masses to the fermions? And we said that, oh, you introduce a Higgs boson, and everything's beautiful, and that's how we can explain these masses. Well, there's a mass term associated with the Higgs, which has to be quite low. Now, quite low compared to what? If you say something is really low, you have to compare it to something. Well, you compare it to other scales that we think we know about in nature, which is, for example, the Planck scale. So this is the hierarchy problem. And you say, well, why is it a problem? I just set the mass to that scale. Well, there's, if I look at the one loop corrections to a fundamental scalar like this, there might be some loop factor, but then there's a quadratic divergence associated with maybe some states or that couple to the Higgs at whatever order, through gravity, etc. And so there's this is the so-called quadratic sensitivity. And the rules of effective field theory tell you that you should expect that operators should get coefficients as large as they can unless they are protected by some symmetry. Now, there is no identifiable obvious symmetry in the standard model that says it's associated with this operator. Now, you can start dreaming up. You can start dreaming up symmetries which then have implications. And those implications say you are now beyond the standard model. But in the simple vision of the standard model, there is no symmetry that says this is protected. And so it's bizarre that this coefficient should be so small compared to in Planck or some other high scale. So what do we do about that? Well, there are many solutions. Yes?
You're saying nobody believes it. One thing you haven't talked about is the consistency of the Higgs doublet with the origin of mass of the fermions and then how it's consistent with the CKM picture, which is also a very non-trivial thing. It doesn't tell you anything about the Higgs mass, but is your lack of discussing it just because it's not talking about the Higgs mass? I mean, wouldn't you also consider that supporting evidence for the Higgs mechanism?
I would say absolutely it's a supporting mechanism. It's a supporting argument for a Higgs-like state, yes.
Okay.
And I don't have time to talk about the flavor sector, but this all accommodates the flavor sector. You can turn it around and say, I have another problem on my hands in the standard model, and that I don't understand why there's huge hierarchies between the electron mass and the top quark mass. And this Higgs mechanism doesn't tell me anything insightful about that at all. The only thing it does is it says that it can accommodate it. I can put these arbitrarily small Yukawa couplings in front of these fermion operators to get the electron counts out. So I can turn it both ways. I can make a smiley face and say the Higgs accommodates it. I can make a frowny face by saying it has no explanatory power over the flavor problem. And there's a whole group of beyond the standard model physics pursuits that attempt to explain that.
You would agree it doesn't need to explain the Kawa just because of chiral symmetry protecting things.
That's right. It's a so-called technically natural theory, the Higgs, from the point of view of flavor. From the point of view of flavor, and it's one of the reasons why I'm not talking about that too much, is this is not really technically natural, because there's no symmetry that tells you this is small. But the chiral symmetries protect the fermion and Yukawa couplings to be very small. So if I had a really small Yukawa coupling for a fermion, I'm not going to generate it. So I assume that you know what I'm referring to here, but in case others don't, a mass term, so I have chirality arrows on here. It's the fermion left and the fermion right. Now, the Higgs mechanism gives you a vacuum expectation value that ultimately gives mass to the fermions, okay? And with this Yukawa coupling. Now, if I look throughout the entire standard model and I say, well, I want to do some loop diagrams of this, I can have an F left, and I have an F right. I want to start drawing loop diagrams and see if I can get some quantum effect. It goes much higher than this. Well, draw to your heart's content. Put BEVs where you need to, perhaps, and mass insertion, and so on. Draw to your heart's content, and you'll find that it will have to go like some parameter over 60, some loop factor times MF. You're not going to do better than that. And so it's protected by this so-called chiral symmetry. Chiral symmetry being the left and right operator. Okay, so this was problem number two, is that nobody believes it.
How do we start believing it? What do we need to do to add to the theory to make this acceptable? And the term that I give to this is the Higgs entourage. So the Higgs is like an NBA player. It can't survive on its own. It needs lots of other people around it, and it needs to accompany it to nightclubs and wherever else they go. The Higgs boson just cannot survive on its own. And this entourage, theoretical entourage, states entourage, and so on, is what I want to talk about. Now, what are the two main areas of physics beyond the standard model that are three main areas that can explain the stability of this weak scale? Well, number one, the fermions don't have these problems of quadratic divergences, so we can banish all scalars from the theory. So that could be our first explanation. Banish fermions. I don't know if I should, where should I write? Oh, I'll write here. Banish scalar, sorry. So this is Technicolor, some Higgsless ideas, and so on. This is a beautiful idea. I think it doesn't work as well as the other two that I'm going to mention, even though in some twisted way the other two are related to this. But the idea of banishing scalars is really beautiful because nature already demonstrates a mechanism by which this could work. And it's chiral symmetry breaking in QCD. In QCD, there is the quarks, a Q left, Q right, have some lambda QCD value. This is chiral symmetry breaking in QCD, and we think about it entirely from the standpoint of SU3. But this vacuum expectation of this bilinear has the same quantum numbers as the Higgs. It's sort of a Higgs quantum numbers. And if there were no Higgs boson at all in the standard model, we would still get mass for the W and Z. And the mass would arise from this condensate, this bilinear condensate. And then the mass would be, unfortunately, too small. It would be 70 MeV or something, or 80 MeV. But we would have a mass. There would be spontaneous symmetry breaking in the electroweak sector from this. Okay, so this wasn't quite good enough. So you add more states to the theory, make this Q left prime, Q right prime. These are some new exotic techni fermions. And then call this lambda QCD prime or something, some techni color group rather than color group. And but have the same SU2 and U1 numbers, the same electroweak quantum numbers, keep those the same, but then just make a new symmetry that condenses like this. Well, the trouble is that it just doesn't seem to work very easily. There's no theorem that this is not how nature works. But you end up getting Goldstone bosons and pseudo-Nambu Goldstone bosons running around that can create problems with phenomenology. Colliders haven't seen them yet. There's some precision electroweak problems probably with this approach. So I'm not going to talk about it any more than what I just said. Second approach is extra dimensions. Or banish in Planck. So this one loop quadratic sensitivity goes all the way up to in Planck. Well, if in Planck were in the neighborhood of the weak scale, then I wouldn't have to worry about it. So I could be quadratically sensitive all day long, and it doesn't matter as long as you're in the neighborhood of the weak scale. I'll talk more about this. I think this is a pretty interesting idea, and there's consequences for the LHC on it. And then the third is SUSY, and the supersymmetric case is to me really quite elegant, and there's lots of things that work very well on this. The supersymmetric case, unfortunately, does not have just not one Higgs, but rather two Higgs bosons. And so it looks like it might be qualitatively different story than the standard model. In the extra dimensional case, this makes one Higgs okay. So I will talk about some subtleties, but from this immediate standpoint, I can just say, okay, we have extra dimensions plus we have one Higgs boson, just like the standard model Higgs. The quadratic sensitivity is no longer a problem, and I have phenomenology very similar to a standard model phenomenology. So that's a prospect for the extra dimensions. I will tell you a bit about how that can change, but that's a prospect. In supersymmetry, no such luck. Supersymmetry, there's two Higgs doublets minimum, and that's it. You can't get away from it. And that's not the standard model solution. But the standard model, see, I don't know if I should do it now or not. The Higgs solution in the supersymmetric case, which I guess I'll probably start next time because I want to open up for some questions, is going to ultimately look very similar to the standard model Higgs, and but with some subtle differences that we can explore. And we will also determine whether or not supersymmetry can allow us to be in this region, and what kind of implications for LHC physics would have, not only for the Higgs boson sector, but also for superpartner spectrum at the LHC. Yes?
MSSN has even lights and lower Higgs, which is bad. Secondly, you have to buy 223 free parameters. That's a big price. I mean, free parameters.
Not necessarily, but we'll talk about it. And the MSSM, so one of the difficulties of the MSSM is to get above this line, or to get above 114 GeV. And what I will do for you is I will derive for you next time very simple way of seeing what the leading order corrections are, quantum corrections are, to the light Higgs boson of supersymmetry. But I, my viewpoint is that you have to be a radical naturalist to think the MSSM is severely strained by this limit. I mean, there's some tension, but I don't think it's severely strained. If you go beyond the MSSM, you can get to almost arbitrarily high values. And for you supersymmetry experts, I will tell you immediately how you can get to arbitrarily high values for the Higgs mass in supersymmetry. And that is, you add this to the superpotential, and you add, there's an F of S term in the scalar potential, which gives me lambda squared, H up squared, H down squared. The light Higgs will be proportional to lambda squared. It's always proportional to the 5 to the 4th couplings. And so there's this new free parameter, lambda squared, 5 to the 4th coupling. The MH squared is, there's a term that goes by lambda squared in the computation for the light Higgs mass. And lambda can be anything. And so, therefore, MH can be anything. If you want the theory to remain perturbative up to some high scale, lambda gets bounded, because lambda tends to want to run to high values as a function of scale. And if you want to make sure that it doesn't have a lambda pole below, say, in Gut or in Planck or something, then there's a limited amount of additional mass that this lambda term can add to the theory. But if you're not wedded to complete perturbative supersymmetry all the way up to the very high scale, then formally the limit on the Higgs mass, the light Higgs mass in supersymmetry, can be any value. But if you want a calculable at the weak scale, then it's limited by the normal considerations of perturbativity and longitudinal boson scattering, and so on. So this limit will play a role in supersymmetry, but I don't think it's a dramatic role.
There's a possibility for Higgs simply doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's, I sort of put that in possibility one, but we can call that four if you like.
The experiments will tell us.
Yes, that's the beauty of it. Experiment will tell us in the short term.
In the supersymmetric case, is the lower limit still 114, or is it, how far down does it come?
Ah, very good. So in the supersymmetric case, the lower limit is, It's hard to.
Depends on which one, probably.
Yeah, it depends on the expansion. But this gives me an opportunity to tell you just a brief background before I answer that question. Okay, there's two Higgs doublets in supersymmetry. So it's two complex Higgs doublets, it's 8 degrees of freedom. So now I break SU2 across U1 hypercharge down to U1 ENM. There's 3 degrees of freedom that get eaten by that. Those 3 degrees of freedom are the longitudinal W plus, W minus, Z. So there's 5 degrees of freedom left. Now, 5 is an awkward number. So it's sort of 5 is 4 plus 1. And it turns out that if this supersymmetry mass scale gets higher and higher, then 4 of those 5 degrees of freedom decouple to arbitrarily high values with the supersymmetry breaking mass scale. So 4 of those 5 degrees of freedom just go whoop, up like that. Supersymmetry is a decoupling theory, so you know that's going to be the case. You're restricting yourself to getting the electroweak scale out in the end. And so 1 degree of freedom is left behind. That one degree of freedom left behind is something that acts just like standard model Higgs. In fact, as you decouple that those 4 degrees of freedom, the remaining degree of freedom is exactly the standard model of Higgs behavior in every way. So in that case, that limit applies. But if the supersymmetry breaking mass scale is lower and it's near the weak scale, then there's mixing that takes place between the one of the other CP even eigenstates and the so-called light CP eigenstate. There's funny mixing that goes on. And that funny mixing can lead to diminished couplings to the vector bosons for a particular eigenstate. So you can have two Higgs eigenstates, which are roughly around the same mass. They do a level repulsion due to some mixing effects. And the mass eigenstate that's left behind, there's one that's below the kinematic accessibility of left. There's another mass eigenstate that's above the kinematic accessibility of left. So that one's out. The heavier one is out. You'll never see it. The lighter one, you have a hope of seeing, but it mixed so heavily with this other one that it's lost its couplings, so to speak, with the vector boson. It doesn't have full coupling. It doesn't act completely like a standard model Higgs. And in those circumstances, you may be able to hide the Higgs boson at lighter values of mass in this region. So this whole region assumes you have full standard model light couplings. So you can hide it.
But once you start the supersymmetry breaking approaches to TeV, why wouldn't you have seen supersymmetry tevatron?
The tevatron is the tevatron limits are 200 TeV at most for Schwarz and Luinos. So it's interesting you should bring up the 1 TeV remark, because let's go back to 1984 again. And we'll talk more about supersymmetry, but we're in sort of a question-answer discussion time, so...
I'm interrupting you.
No, that's fine. No, it's okay. So in 1984, there's physics reports and things that are written on supersymmetry. What they say is that the superpartner spectrum should show up between 0 and 1 TeV. Somewhere below about 1 TeV. Limits on superpartner masses at LEP 2 are 100 GeV. So you've got one-tenth the distance from LEP 2. From Tevatron, limits are about 200 GeV. Actually, a little higher, it depends on the relative masses of the superpartners. So in some cases, you might be able to go up to 300 GeV for Bluinos if everything works out perfectly. So that's near a third of the way there. And LHC will get us all the way there.
You need a 14 TeV LHC, not the 7.
Yeah, 7 TeV is not going to get us all the way there, but 14 hopefully will. 14 will cover, I think, the vast part of this parameter space. Yes.
So this chi-squared analysis, well, you briefly mentioned that the correlation that goes to the self-defense, right? It's based on assumptions about none of those theory can change the decoupling for...
You're worried that this limit would change if I have a new theory.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So, in the case of the supersymmetric one, it decouples extraordinarily rapidly from precision electrowave analysis. If you have superpartner masses above 200 GeV, no effect. I mean, it's a negligible effect. It's really quite extraordinary. Unless you have a really strange parameters that come in, and then the light Higgs is very rapidly decouples to a standard model Higgs. And so that upper limit applies quite well. Yeah. Now, I have been in the game, and others have been in the game of trying to look at supersymmetry, which is near the weak scale, to see if improvements can be made on the fit. And the fit is already pretty good with the standard model, And there's a vast amount of parameter space where the fit is very similar to a standard model, or maybe slightly better, by having some light states around, and you can twist and turn the parameters a bit. But overall, it's the decoupling limit is the so-called decoupling limit is a very effective parameter space for this.
So there's no positive delta T contribution for the superpartners when you're above 200 dB. You can never tell a story like that to read things, but
there's no necessarily positive delta T. You might have been referring to delta S. But a delta T it's an isospin breaking type of correction. So you have the top score and you have the bottom score could be separated by a large amount. And then that and that would lead to sort of an isospin breaking and a positive contribution to delta T. There's no delta S type correction, but you know you're not decoupling a generation in sort of a non-decoupling generation in supersymmetry like you are, say, in a fourth generation. So a fourth generation, you make go arbitrarily high, you get positive delta S corrections because it's not really truly a decoupling theory. But in supersymmetry, you raise the supersymmetry breaking masses and a whole sectors go along with it that they don't cause problems for precision electroweak, and you get zero for these delta S, delta T corrections. Decoupled to zero. Okay. So then in the last just 60 seconds, I just want to state that these quadratic sensitivities and these issues of fine-tuning and so on, they're not super rigorous. It's very hard to talk very rigorously about them. But what we want to do is we want to kill fine tunings and hierarchy problems of 10 to the 16 GeV, 10 to the 18 GeV, and 10 to the 13 GeV. But we don't necessarily need or must kill some hierarchies that are 10 to the 2 and 10 to the 3. Now, that's my personal view about how the hierarchies and fine tunings operate. And at times I will tell you about some theories where the fine tuning is very minimal, and other times it's as high as 10 to the 3. But I think we'll all agree that 10 to the 16 tunings are probably not so good.
So Susie, is that 5T?
Yeah, that's
a good.
That doesn't bother me.
It's a different kind of tuning because it's a quadratic. I mean, it's not like chiral.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's in the supersymmetry breaking case that lambda in the upper right hand corner of that board gets replaced by MSUSI partner square. And I'm not sure that 10 TeV should keep me awake at night, or even 100 TeV should keep me awake at night. 10 to the 17 TeV keeps me awake. I have to think a lot harder about that. Yes?
Can I ask about this mechanism you were mentioning before for pushing one of the eigenstates below 114 GeV? Do you have to then, to suppress the couplings to the W's and Z's, do you have to tune? Is there some very severe fine tuning that has to be done there, or no?
Not really. There is a tuning for sure because you have to make sure that you're in concert with the data, and it's very hard to give a rigorous statement of what the tuning is. But all you need is this extra state to just have a small enough coupling is smaller than depends on what the mass is. But there's a plot from LEP 2 of what the coupling has to be less than for a mass less than 114 GeV in order to not have been seen or ruled out by experiment. And it's not, I would not declare that's any big huge fine tuning to do that. The biggest problem, though, is that if you do have all these Higgs states light, then it's correlated with other superpartners being light, really quite light. And there's ways around it that involve some tuning, but so I'm not a big fan of hiding the Higgs below the
much below 114 GeV. I don't have anything strong against it, but it's just not the direction that I think is most fruitful to think about superconductor.
You haven't mentioned the Higgs problem, the logical process.
Yes.
And also the reality process.
Yes, there will be lots of things that I won't mention. Yeah.
That's probably a good place to.
Okay.
Yeah.